Chapter 39. A Stone, the son of a Peter Peterson. Our militia company were not learned, and the explanation confused them, so they called him Peterson Dunlop. He proved useful to us in his way. He named our camps for us, and he generally struck a name that was no slouch, apostrophe as the boy said. That is one sample of us. Another was Ed Stevens, son of the town jeweler. Trim built, handsome, graceful, neat as a cat, bright, educated, but given over entirely to fun. There was nothing serious in life to him. As far as he was concerned, this military expedition of ours was simply a holiday. I should say that about half of us looked upon it in the same way, not consciously, perhaps, but unconsciously. We did not think, we were not capable of it. As for myself, I was full of unreasoning joy, to be done with turning out of bed at midnight and 4 in the morning, for a while, grateful to have a change, new scenes, new occupations, a new interest. In my thoughts, that was as far as I went. I did not go into the details, as a rule one doesn't at 25. Another sample was Smith, the blacksmith's apprentice. This vast donkey had some pluck, of a slow and sluggish nature, but a soft heart. At one time he would knock a horse down for some impropriety, and at another he would get homesick and cry. However, he had one ultimate credit to his account which some of us hadn't. He stuck to the war, and was killed in battle at last. Joe Bowers, another sample, was a huge, good-natured, flax-headed lubber. Lazy, sentimental, full of harmless brag, a grumbler by nature, an experienced, industrious, ambitious, and often quite picturesque liar, and yet not a successful one, for he had had no intelligent training, but was allowed to come up just anyway. This life was serious enough to him, and seldom satisfactory. But he was a good fellow, anyway, and the boys all liked him. He was made orderly sergeant. Stevens was made corporal. These samples will answer, and they are quite fair ones. Well, this herd of cattle started for the war. What could you expect of them? They did as well as they knew how, but really what was justly to be expected of them? Nothing, I should say. That is what they did. We waited for a dark night, for caution and secrecy were necessary. Then, toward midnight, we stole in couples, and from various directions to the Griffith place, beyond the town. From that point we set out together on foot. Hannibal lies at the extreme southeastern corner of Marion County, on the Mississippi River. Our objective point was the hamlet of New London, 10 miles away, in Rawls County. The first hour was all fun, all idle nonsense and laughter. But that could not be kept up. The steady trudging came to be like work. The play had somehow oozed out of it. The stillness of the woods and the somberness of the night began to throw a depressing influence over the spirits of the boys, and presently the talking died out, and each person shut himself up in his own thoughts. During the last half of the second hour nobody said a word. Now we approached a log farmhouse where, according to report, there was a guard of 5 Union soldiers. Lyman called a halt, and there, in the deep gloom of the overhanging branches, he began to whisper a plan of assault upon that house, which made the gloom more depressing than it was before. It was a crucial moment. We realized, with a cold suddenness, that here was no jest. We were standing face to face with actual war. We were equal to the occasion. In our response there was no hesitation, no indecision. We said that, if Lyman wanted to meddle with those soldiers, he could go ahead and do it, but if he waited for us to follow him, he would wait a long time. Lyman urged, pleaded, tried to shame us, but it had no effect. Our course was plain, our minds were made up. We would flank the farmhouse, go out around. And that is what we did. We turned the position. We struck into the woods, and entered upon a rough time, stumbling over roots, getting tangled in vines, and torn by briers. At last we reached an open place in a safe region, and sat down, blown and hot, to cool off and nurse our scratches and bruises. Lyman was annoyed, but the rest of us were cheerful. We had flanked the farmhouse, we had made our first military movement, and it was a success. We had nothing to fret about, we were feeling just the other way. Horseplay and laughing began again. The expedition was become a holiday frolic once more. Then we had two more hours of dull trudging and ultimate silence and depression. Then, about dawn, we straggled into New London, soiled, heel-dashed, blistered, fagged with our little march, and all of us except Stevens, in a sour and raspy humor and privately down on the war. We stacked our shabby old shotguns in Colonel Rawl's barn, and then went in a body and break-faced with that veteran of the Mexican War. Afterwards he took us to a distant meadow, and there in the shade of a tree we listened to an old-fashioned speech from him, full of gunpowder and glory, full of that adjective piling, mixed metaphor, and windy declamation which was regarded as eloquence in that ancient time and that remote region. And then he swore us on the Bible to be faithful to the state of Missouri, and drive all invaders from her soil, no matter whence they might come, or under what flag they might march. This mixed us considerably, and we could not make out just what service we were embarked in. But Colonel Rawls, the practiced politician and phrase juggler, was not similarly in doubt. He knew quite clearly that he had invested us in the cause of the Southern Confederacy. He closed the solemnities by belting around me the sword which his neighbor, Colonel Brown, had worn at Buena Vista and Molino del Rey, and he accompanied this act with another impressive blast. Then we formed in line of battle and marched 4 miles to a shady and pleasant piece of woods on the border of the far-reached expanses of a flowery prairie. It was an enchanting region for war, our kind of war. We pierced the forest about half a mile, and took up a strong position, with some low, rocky, and wooded hills behind us, and a purling, limpid creek in front. Straightway half the command were in swimming, and the other half fishing. The Yass with the French name gave this position a romantic title, but it was too long, so the boys shortened, and simplified it to Camp Rawls. We occupied an old maple sugar camp, whose half-rotted troughs were still propped against the trees. A long corn crib served for sleeping quarters for the battalion. On our left, half a mile away, was Mason's farm and house, and he was a friend to the cause. Shortly after noon the farmers began to arrive from several directions, with mules and horses for our use, and these they lent us for as long as the war might last, which they judged would be about 3 months. The animals were of all sizes, all colors, and all breeds. They were mainly young and frisky, and nobody in the command could stay on them long at a time, for we were town boys, and ignorant of horsemanship. The creature that fell to my share was a very small mule, and yet so quick and active that it could throw me without difficulty, and it did this whenever I got on it. Then it would bray, stretching its neck out, laying its ears back, and spreading its jaws till you could see down to its works. It was a disagreeable animal in every way. If I took it by the bridle and tried to lead it off the grounds, it would sit down and brace back, and no one could budge it. However, I was not entirely destitute of military resources, and I did presently manage to spoil this game, for I had seen many a steamboat aground in my time, and knew a trick or two which even a grounded mule would be obliged to respect. There was a well by the corn crib. So I substituted 30 fathom of rope for the bridle, and fetched him home with the windlass. I will anticipate here sufficiently to say that we did learn to ride, after some days' practice, but never well. We could not learn to like our animals, they were not choice ones, and most of them had annoying peculiarities of one kind or another. Stephen's horse would carry him, when he was not noticing, under the huge excrescences which form on the trunks of oak trees, and wipe him out of the saddle. In this way Stephen's got several bad hurts. Sergeant Bower's horse was very large and tall, with slim, long legs, and looked like a railroad bridge. His size enabled him to reach all about, and as far as he wanted to, with his head, so he was always biting Bowers' legs. On the march, in the sun, Bowers slept a good deal, and as soon as the horse recognized that he was asleep he would reach around and bite him on the leg. His legs were black and blue with bites. This was the only thing that could ever make him swear, but this always did. Whenever the horse bit him he always swore, and of course Stevens, who laughed at everything, laughed at this, and would even get into such convulsions over it as to lose his balance and fall off his horse. And then Bowers, already irritated by the pain of the horse bite, would resent the laughter with hard language, and there would be a quarrel, so that horse made no end of trouble, and bad blood in the command. However, I will get back to where I was our first afternoon in the sugar camp. The sugar troughs came very handy as horse troughs, and we had plenty of corn to fill them with. I ordered Sergeant Bowers to feed my mule, but he said that, if I reckoned he went to war to be dry nurse to a mule, it wouldn't take me very long to find out my mistake. I believed that this was insubordination, but I was full of uncertainties about everything military, and so I let the thing pass, and went and ordered Smith, the blacksmith's apprentice, to feed the mule, but he merely gave me a large, cold, sarcastic grin, such as an ostensibly 7-year-old horse gives you when you lift his lip and find he is 14, and turned his back on me. I then went to the captain and asked if it was not right and proper and military for me to have an orderly. He said it was, but as there was only one orderly in the corps, it was but right that he himself should have Bowers on his staff. Bowers said he wouldn't serve on anybody's staff, and if anybody thought he could make him, let him try it. So, of course, the thing had to be dropped. There was no other way. Next, nobody would cook. It was considered a degradation. So we had no dinner. We lazied the rest of the pleasant afternoon away, some dozing under the trees, some smoking cob pipes and talking sweethearts and war, some playing games. By late supper time all hands were famished. And to meet the difficulty all hands turned to, on an equal footing, and gathered wood, built fires, and cooked the meal. Afterward everything was smooth for a while, then trouble broke out between the corporal and the sergeant, each claiming to rank the other. Nobody knew which was the higher office, so Lyman had to settle the matter by making the rank of both officers equal. The commander of an ignorant crew like that has many troubles and vexations which probably do not occur in the regular army at all. However, with the song singing and yarn spinning around the campfire, everything presently became serene again, and by we raked the corn down level in one end of the crib, and all went to bed on it, tying a horse to the door, so that he would neigh if anyone tried to get in. 1. We had some horsemanship drill every forenoon. Then, afternoons, we rode off here and there in squads a few miles, and visited the farmer's girls, and had a youthful good time, and got an honest good dinner or supper, and then home again to camp, happy and content. For a time, life was idly delicious. It was perfect. There was nothing to mar it. Then came some farmers with an alarm one day. They said it was rumored that the enemy were advancing in our direction, from over Hyde's Prairie. The result was a sharp stir among us, and general consternation. It was a rude awakening from our pleasant trance. The rumor was but a rumor, nothing definite about it. So, in the confusion, we did not know which way to retreat. Lyman was for not retreating at all, in these uncertain circumstances. But he found that, if he tried to maintain that attitude he would fare badly, for the command were in no humor to put up with insubordination. So he yielded the point, and called a council of war to consist of himself and the 3 other officers. But the privates made such a fuss about being left out, that we had to allow them to remain, for they were already present, and doing the most of the talking too. The question was, which way to retreat, but all were so flurried, that nobody seemed to have even a guess to offer. Except Lyman. He explained in a few calm words that inasmuch as the enemy were approaching from over Heights Prairie, our course was simple. All we had to do was not to retreat toward him. Any other direction would answer our needs perfectly. Everybody saw in a moment how true this was, and how wise, so Lyman got a great many compliments. It was now decided that we should fall back upon Mason's farm. It was after dark by this time, and as we could not know how soon the enemy might arrive, it did not seem best to try to take the horses and things with us. So we only took the guns and ammunition, and started at once. The route was very rough and hilly and rocky, and presently the night grew very black, and rain began to fall, so we had a troublesome time of it, struggling and stumbling along in the dark, and soon some person slipped and fell, and then the next person behind stumbled over him and fell, and so did the rest, one after the other. And then Bowers came with a keg of powder in his arms, whilst the command were all mixed together, arms and legs, on the muddy slope. And so he fell, of course, with the keg, and this started the whole detachment down the hill in a body, and they landed in the brook at the bottom in a pile, and each that was undermost pulling the hair and scratching and biting those that were on top of him. And those that were being scratched and bitten, scratching and biting the rest in their turn, and all saying they would die before they would ever go to war again, if they ever got out of this brook this time, and the invader might rot for all they cared, and the country along with them, and all such talk as that, which was dismal to hear and take part in such smothered, low voices, and such a grisly dark place and so wet, and the enemy may be coming any moment. The keg of powder was lost, and the guns too, so the growling and complaining continued straight along, whilst the brigade pawed around the pasty hillside, and slopped around in the brook hunting for these things. Consequently we lost considerable time with this. And then we heard a sound, and held our breath and listened, and it seemed to be the enemy coming, though it could have been a cow, for it had a cough like a cow. But we did not wait, but left a couple of guns behind, and struck out for Mason's again as briskly as we could scramble along in the dark. But we got lost presently among the rugged little ravines, and wasted a deal of time finding the way again, so it was after 9, when we reached Mason's stile at last, and then before we could open our mouths to give the countersign, several dogs came bounding over the fence, with great riot and noise, and each of them took a soldier by the slack of his trousers, and began to back away with him. We could not shoot the dogs without endangering the persons they were attached to, so we had to look on, helpless, at what was perhaps the most mortifying spectacle of the Civil War. There was light enough, and to spare, for the Masons had now run out on the porch with candles in their hands. The old man and his son came and undid the dogs without difficulty, all but Bowers. But they couldn't undo his dog, they didn't know his combination. He was of the bull kind, and seemed to be set with a Yale time lock, but they got him loose at last with some scalding water, of which Bowers got his share and returned thanks. Peterson Dunlap afterwards made up a fine name for this engagement, and also for the night march which preceded it, but both have long ago faded out of my memory. We now went into the house, and they began to ask us a world of questions, whereby it presently came out that we did not know anything concerning who or what we were running from. So the old gentleman made himself very frank, and said we were a curious breed of soldiers, and guessed we could be depended on to end up the war in time, because no government could stand the expense of the shoe leather we should cost it trying to follow us around. Marion Rangers. Good name, gosh! Apostrophe said he. And wanted to know why we hadn't had a picket guard at the place where the road entered the prairie, and why we hadn't sent out a scouting party to spy out the enemy, and bring us an account of his strength, and so on, before jumping up and stampeding out of a strong position upon a mere vague rumor, and so on, and so forth. Till he made us all feel shabbier than the dogs had done, and not half so enthusiastically welcome. So we went to bed shamed and low-spirited. Except Stevens. Soon Stevens began to devise a garment for Bowers which could be made to automatically display his battle scars to the grateful, or conceal them from the envious, according to his occasions. But Bowers was in no humor for this, so there was a fight, and when it was over Stevens had some battle scars of his own to think about. Then we got a little sleep. But after all we had gone through, our activities were not over for the night. For about 2 o'clock in the morning we heard a shout of warning from down the lane, accompanied by a chorus from all the dogs, and in a moment everybody was up, and flying around to find out what the alarm was about. The alarmist was a horseman who gave notice that a detachment of Union soldiers was on its way from Hannibal with orders to capture and hang any bands like ours which it could find, and said we had no time to lose. Farmer Mason was in a flurry this time, himself. He hurried us out of the house with all haste, and sent one of his negroes with us to show us where to hide ourselves and our telltale guns among the ravines, half a mile away. It was raining heavily. We struck down the lane, then across some rocky pasture land which offered good advantages for stumbling. Consequently we were down in the mud most of the time, and every time a man went down he blackguarded the war, and the people who started it, and everybody connected with it, and gave himself the master dose of all four, being so foolish as to go into it. At last we reached the wooded mouth of a ravine, and there we... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.